Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Spoke at the American Legion's National Convention in Salt Lake City, a friendly crowd that also hosted Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld this week. That full-court press is seen as an effort to bolster public support for the Iraqi war. Today, the president repeated a theme mentioned by Secretary Rumsfeld earlier this week.
As veterans, you have seen this kind of enemy before. There are successors to fascists, to Nazis, to communists, and other totalitarians of the 20th century. And history shows what the outcome will be. This war will be difficult, this war will be long, and this war will end in the defeat of the terrorists and totalitarians and a victory for the cause of freedom and liberty.
Joining us on the line, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek, Richard Wolff. And Richard, today's speech and the language being used, tell us more about what seems to be a coordinated message from the administration heard in speeches from Vice President Dick Cheney and Secretaries Rice and Rumsfeld.
Well, certainly it's coordinated that you have a whole series now this August period just before the midterm campaigns really get underway seriously after Labor Day. But some of the language they're using, people are finding surprising, has actually really been a common piece of the administration's argument dating back to straight after the war in Afghanistan, the link between fascism, communism, totalitarianism, and the other side broadly in the war on terror is a keynote, really, of the president's language about this war as it's been played out over the last several years.
Well, some of the words we're hearing more of, though, have infuriated Democrats who blasted Secretary Rumsfeld for his speech in which he likened critics of U.S. policy in Iraq to those who appeased or tried to appease Hitler before World War II. You know, what are Democrats saying?
Well, Democrats obviously find this a terrible slur and also a mischaracterization of their position. And one thing that is striking here is, of course, this debate is not about whether to fight the war on terror. It's about whether to keep troops in Iraq. And Democrats are certainly feeling more emboldened to be more vocal in pushing back against this kind of attack, because public opinion broadly is with them when it comes to withdrawal.
But I want to ask you, though, coming up to the elections, Republicans are also, you know, many of them against the war in Iraq, and they're being, in effect, called appeasers. Is that going to backfire?
Right. And this is a big problem for the administration. How to talk about this debate when public opinion, again, it's not about immediate withdrawal, but people want to see troops out within a year. That's where the vast majority of public opinion is now, and Republican candidates are reflecting that. Of course, the administration has a different perspective. First of all, the president isn't running for election, so he can base his opinions and his statements more broadly on the policy priorities he has. And also, they think this is an effective way to try and reclaim this debate and maybe nudge public opinion back in their own direction.
Well, while we have you, I also want to ask about Iran. The president spoke about Iran in his speech, calling that country a grave threat. Today, as you know, was the deadline set by the UN Security Council for Iran to stop enriching uranium. The UN's nuclear agency released its report today saying Iran is showing no signs of stopping uranium enrichment, although there are also reports that there's not as much of it as might have been thought. But was there anything in the speech, in about the minute we have, that maybe foreshadowed the administration's plans for Iran?
Well, certainly there is an attempt to tie all of these strands together: Hezbollah, Iran, Iraq, Al-Qaeda. So that is a part of a concerted effort. But really right now, the administration's focus is on the diplomacy, on the UN, more than public opinion. So there's some element of laying the foundations for the future, but right now he's got to do a lot more work with countries like Russia than he has with American public opinion.
That's Newsweek senior White House correspondent Richard Wolff talking to us about President Bush's speech today at the American Legion National Convention in Salt Lake City. And this speech, by the way, begins a series of presidential speeches over the next 20 days, and they are said to be focusing on the fifth anniversary of 9/11. And just very, very quickly, Richard, the president is also saying they're not political, but they can't help but be.
Of course, the president is pinning his legacy on not just Iraq, but on winning this round of midterm elections, and people are worried about the results. So, yes, everything is political right now.
Richard, thanks so much.
Anytime.
Well, staying out west, polygamist Warren Jeffs, the leader of a breakaway fundamentalist Mormon group, appears in a Las Vegas courtroom today. Utah authorities want Jeffs to be returned to that state to face rape charges for his alleged role in helping to arrange an underage marriage. Jeffs also faces similar charges in Arizona, but yesterday prosecutors from both states agreed that Utah should proceed first, as Utah's penalties are stiffer and bail requirements higher. Well, Jeffs is the self-proclaimed prophet of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, or FLDS, a huge polygamous community based in both Hilldale, Utah, and Colorado City, Arizona. Jeffs was on the run and on America's Most Wanted list until his arrest earlier this week. And while the focus of news accounts about him have been on the alleged child brides in FLDS, there's another side effect of that group equally disturbing to children's advocates in the area. Over 400 boys, according to the Utah Attorney General's office, boys who've been kicked out of the FLDS over the past 5 years because Warren Jeffs saw them as competition for the young brides. The so-called lost boys of polygamy end up in neighboring Hurricane, Utah, and that's where Elaine Tyler comes in. She's with the HOPE Organization of Washington, Utah. It's a volunteer organization that helps those who leave polygamy reintegrate into society, and her work with the boys is winning applause from beleaguered state agencies in the United Way, and we invited her on to learn a little more. Elaine, welcome.
Hi, Robin.
Well, first of all, why are these boys kicked out?
Some of them leave on their own because the lifestyle is just far too restrictive. They can't wear T-shirts, they can't date girls, they can't watch movies, they can't listen to CDs.
We understand no music.
Well, Warren's singing is allowed. He considers himself a musician. Actually, he's written some pretty good stuff, if you like a lot of religious mumbo-jumbo. But that's about all they can listen to, and they want to listen to rock and roll and the hip-hop and all whatever's popular. But I need to correct you on something right off the bat,
sure,
please. There are more than 400 of those boys. I was talking to one of the boys about 2 weeks ago, and he told me that he personally knows 400 in the St. George area, and he says there are at least 1,000 of these boys between the age of 16 and 25 living in the St. George area.
That's an astonishing number, and we understand that another reason that they are kicked out is that they threaten Warren Jeffs and other adults, that they pose competition for young brides?
Absolutely. It's a numbers game. They start flirting with the girls, start getting girlfriends, and that's a potential child bride that another man can't have, usually an older man.
What do these boys say, particularly the ones who are run off?
It's so sad. Some of them say, you know, I really want to visit my brothers and sisters, and my parents won't let me. Some of the guys will say that their mothers will sneak into St. George and bring them some home-cooked food, and they'll tell me that's the thing they miss the most is the home-cooked food.
Well, you mentioned the mothers. How do they allow this to happen?
They ought to bring criminal charges against the parent for child neglect. But Warren has such mind control over his followers. He expects 100% obedience, so he tells the parents, your son is not welcome. He's not welcome any longer in your family. You can never speak to them again. You must ask him to leave. Otherwise, you're going to go to hell.
Well, we understand, too, they can't go to the police.
The police are polygamists. They're in the organization. So they are loyal to Warren. One of the ways that the boys are run out is that the police will just start picking on them and harassing them and pulling them over for little or any reason at all and give them traffic tickets. And these kids can't afford them, and the police are just, oh, they're so underhanded. They'll say, you know, son, if you'll leave town, I'll just take this off the books, and we'll just erase your debt, and you just go on about your merry way and get out of town.
We understand these police also act as, you know, pretty much informants for Jeffs, or did anyway, looking for violations and reporting back to him.
Yes, and I've talked to the Attorney General's office about it, and the dilemma is that Hilldale and Colorado City are incorporated towns. So even if Post, the group that polices the police, if you will, for lack of a better term, but if Post decertifies these police officers, then the towns can just go hire more.
Well, in the meantime, these kids, as you say, could be upwards of 1,000, at least 400 over the past few years, end up in the towns around Colorado City. What are they like when they get there?
Oh, my gosh, they're just so innocent. They are like 15, 16 years old, going on 12. They're very immature. They're very sweet guys. But the first thing they want to do is get their ears pierced. or the tongue pierced, and they start wearing really hip clothes. They'll bleach their hair. One of the other boys that I was talking with, because we were trying to get some life skills classes going for these kids just to teach them survival skills. And we were talking, I was going over the list of potential subjects that would be beneficial to the boys, and alcohol and tobacco and other drugs was on the top of the list. And I said, you know, is this something that we need to do, or do we need to, you know, maybe look at something like budgeting or social skills over and above that? He says, Elaine, you need to consider that every kid coming out of the creek is getting on drugs and or alcohol, I should say. And that just blew me away. They have never had the opportunity or the temptation before. They come out here, they're unsupervised, they have nobody telling them when to go to bed, what to do, and they are just kind of running wild, and they're getting in a lot of trouble.
By the way, a couple things. You said kids coming out of the creek. The creek runs through Colorado City, so they call it the creek, and they call themselves Creekers?
Yes, yes. The town was originally called Short Creek until they incorporated in the 80s. So the kids coming out of there, the people from there call themselves Creekers, and actually they call the people up in Salt Lake Lakers. So there's Creekers and Lakers.
And they find themselves in something called butt huts when they
yeah.
come to these towns. Describe a butt hut.
It's just a flop house. One of the guys will get an apartment. In fact, we've helped some of them get an apartment. And in fact, I was over at one of these one night, and I just was amazed. All of a sudden, there was 30 kids that were there. They just flop wherever they can. If you go over there, you'll see just bodies on sofas, bodies on the floor, because otherwise most of them are living in their car. So they want some semblance of shelter.
And, of course, when you got a bunch of teenage boys crashing at a place for the first time away from any kind of discipline and certainly away from FLDS discipline, you've got drugs and smoking and just sleeping all day, staying up at night.
Doesn't matter. They don't just party for the weekend. They party every single night. And most of them do get up and work. But
what else are they supposed to do? I was telling our listeners here and now that I was just in that area, and it is, you know, picture Thelma and Louise country. It is pretty desolate out there. What can they do?
Well, they can't really do a whole lot out in Colorado City. There used to be sports, and there used to be dances, and there used to be, like, fun activities, good, wholesome fun. And Warren has done away with all of that. There's not even any church anymore after the place was raided looking for him back latter part of last winter.
Well, Ellen Tyler, you talked to these kids, especially this week, and we had hoped to talk to some of them, but they are still very scared and skittish. How do they feel about Warren Jeffs being arrested?
Some of the guys really still admire Warren. When I was talking to him, they say what a wonderful sense of humor he has, what a great baseball player he is, and they're still very devoted to Warren. See, the thing is, when they leave or they're kicked out, they don't lose their religion. They don't just all of a sudden throw that out the window when they leave. So Warren is their prophet. They're taught that he's a man of God. He's God's representative on earth. He's the best thing there is in the whole world. And so they're still trying to struggle with all of that. So I think they really are just concerned of, oh, my gosh, my beloved prophet is in jail.
That's Elaine Tyler of the Hope Organization of Washington, Utah. When we come back after the break, we'll hear from other children of polygamists. Much more ahead here and now. Mormon Church FLDS. Now, if that sounds familiar, it could be that you watched the series Big Love on HBO, which is loosely based on the story of FLDS leader Warren Jeffs, who was arrested this week on charges of arranging underage marriages, and today did waive his extradition rights and is being transferred to Utah to face charges there. It's been quite an active week for polygamy in the Utah area. About a week ago, an unheard-of event. About 300 people from four other fundamentalist Mormon communities held a rally at the Salt Lake City County Building, and in a first, children of polygamy spoke out in defense of their families. Elaine Tyler, I'd like to listen to a little and then hear your opinion.
I'm the 14th child in a large family, and I have several moms.
I like what I see in my home. I like what I see in my community. I claim the privilege of worshiping Almighty God according to the dictates of my own conscience.
We are not brainwashed, mistreated, neglected, malnourished, illiterate, defective, or dysfunctional.
It's a real big PR spin right now. There's a lot of negative feeling right now with Warren, and they want to make sure that that negative feeling is just going to be limited to the FLDS and not the other polygamists. So
but would, they're still illegal. And friends, uh-huh, friends of mine were saying, how is that possible that they could that they could just stand there and nobody come take the children, you know, to some kind of social service care?
Welcome to Utah. That's what blows my mind. Paul Murphy with the Attorney General's office will say, you know, yes, it is illegal, but they don't have the manpower to arrest them. We're talking 30,000, 40,000 polygamists out here now. Where are they going to put the children? They don't have the foster homes. They don't have the jails to put the parents in. And if you want to know the truth, I just don't think a lot of them really care that much about the polygamy. They're focusing on the abuse, and that's what a lot of what the rally was trying to imply, was that we don't have abuse. We're happy, loving families. Let us be. Let us practice our religion as we want. And then it becomes a constitutional issue of they are free, or are they free to practice their religion?
Well, and again, those are the children of polygamist families up north in the Salt Lake area trying to distance themselves from Warren Jeff's sect, which is down in the south of Utah. And I want to turn back to that and back to the lost boys. These are the hundreds of boys that Warren Jeffs is accused of kicking out of his sect because they posed competition for young brides. Has there been any attempt to get these lost boys into foster care, get them to other families or homes?
The boys don't want any part of foster care. First of all, if you ever read the book Lord of the Flies, it is like the Lord of the Flies little society with these kids. And they consider themselves one big happy family, close-knit. They're very dependent upon each other. They understand each other. They've all been through the same experiences. They don't want any part of foster care because that would split them up. And there would be rules and regulations that they don't want to abide by. And I talked to one of the guys, and he said that every single night up here in the park, there are fights with the lost boys versus the other boys in town, the regular kids from St. George, every single night. And he says, Elaine, before long, there is going to be a gang of these lost boys. And to hear that the lost boys may be starting their own gang soon just scares me to death.
You know, we're hearing these things. And then I read that after all the victims of polygamy you've personally seen, and that includes the child brides, the women who've wanted to get out, that you are not against polygamy per se. How's that?
I don't care. I don't want people telling me how to live my life, and I don't care if they practice polygamy or not. That's certainly their choice. But don't go kicking these kids out, and don't go marrying off these little children to old men, and don't evict people out of their homes and reassign families and tear families apart. The abuse is what I'm against, and our whole organization. The other deal is polygamy is, you're never going to win that battle. This is Utah. It's in people's families, and I don't even want to go there with the polygamy.
Well, that raises the question that I've been wanting to ask everyone around this topic. If everyone knows where these families live, if it's been documented that this is sort of a child abuse, this is child abuse, kicking these kids out and marrying underage girls, why hasn't someone just gone into the town and arrested people?
Good question. They had that 53 raid by Governor Pyle out of Phoenix, out of Arizona, and that was a political disaster.
1953, right. Huge backlash.
Yes, huge backlash, and nobody's touched it since then. No politician. It's too much of a hot potato. They do not want to touch it. People have turned a blind eye to this for many, many, many decades, and they just say, let them be out there doing their own thing. They're a happy little group. And, you know, actually, I think they used to be a happy little group till Warren came in.
He replaced his father. One of the first things he did when he had official command is marry about 30 of his father's youngest and prettiest wives.
Yeah, he's marrying his own mothers. Now, how sick is that?
Do you worry with Warren Jeff's arrest, you know, and people now flocking to Colorado City, that some danger lies ahead?
Many of the people have moved out. It's actually quite a ghost town now. He's been moving people out to the other compounds for some time now. But I don't know what's going to happen. I'm not even sure that the people even know he's been arrested. There's no news. They don't read the newspaper, although it's all over today's front page of the Spectrum. And if they go to Walmart, where they frequent, they're going to see that as soon as they walk in the door. Rumor will get around, but it's going to be probably in the next few days that it's going to decide if it's going to be peaceful or not. But the Mojave County and Washington County sheriffs have put extra deputies down there just to patrol it, just to make sure there's peace. And it could, if he's in court, I don't know, it could be, it could get really kind of crazy if they storm that courtroom. I want to go, but I'm thinking at the same time, gosh, you know, I don't know how safe it's going to be.
Well, and we hear some state officials also have concerns. But on a much lighter note, and while we have you, can you tell us more about Colorado City, again, where most of the followers of Warren Jeffs lived? We hear at one time it looked like Little House on the Prairie, with all of the sister wives, as they call themselves, dressed as if in a time warp.
Oh, it's an extreme time warp. They're in pioneer garb, dresses down to the ground, braids down all the way down their waist. They're not allowed to cut their hair because the belief is that they will wash the feet of Jesus with the second coming. So it's unbelievable. It's just turn of the century, even before turn of the century.
Elaine Tyler, again, with the Hope Organization. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, Robin. I sure appreciate it.
And for more information about the Hope Organization, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the Museum of Science Boston, and the National Academy of Engineering, promoting engineering and technological literacy in grades K-12 nationwide. MOS.org/NCTF.
Has been walking a tightrope since 9/11, trying to help the U.S. fight Islamic jihadists in his country without alienating his mostly Muslim countrymen. Many Pakistanis accuse Musharraf of being a puppet of President Bush. They call him Bush-ara. And the opposition calls the government undemocratic. But the most serious challenge to Pakistan's stability may come from the country's resource-rich western province of Balochistan, where a long-simmering nationalist movement has taken up arms, and the Pakistani army recently killed a respected tribal leader. Joining us with an update, Carlotta Gall, Pakistan and Afghanistan correspondent for The New York Times. Carlotta, welcome as always.
Thank you.
You're in Afghanistan today, but we know just returned from Pakistan. So how are the streets there? Is there more quiet or has the rioting continued?
It's still simmering. And when you talk to people in Balochistan, they say they're still very worried and that it's by no means over. We've had 5 days up until yesterday when I was there of street protests, complete strike in Quetta, the capital of Balochistan, where all the shops are closed and the drivers refusing to drive. And so this young students in particular are coming out throwing stones and setting fire to some buildings. So I think it'll simmer on for some time, especially until the government hands over the body of Nawab Bukti and he's buried.
Let's talk about the tribal leader, 79-year-old Nawab Bukti, who was killed when, we understand, military officers went to approach him in a cave and there was an explosion?
Well, that's what we're being told by the government, that there was a 2.5-day battle in the place where he was, and he had a lot of tribesmen with him. We're told that a forward unit actually approached the cave and went into the cave to try and make him surrender. And then there was an explosion which brought down some of the roof of the cave, but it's still not really clear how it ended.
A charismatic leader, part British, educated, attended the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II in London in 1953, had been a member of Parliament in Pakistan at one point.
That's right, and he also served as governor of Balochistan at one point and chief minister of Balochistan. I mean, he'd also been imprisoned for a suspected murder. He was later released, but he's a very colorful figure, and according to some stories, you know, quite a cruel tribal leader. But I think, you know, a symbolic tribal figure. So to kill him, even if in a battle, is going to have its consequences. This is what other Baloch people are telling us.
Well, especially because of this province, let's describe it. It borders both Iran and Afghanistan. And this is a nationalist movement, and at stake is a huge supply of Pakistan's natural gas that's in the region. This isn't an Islamic insurgency. It's a nationalist movement. Why is it so deep?
Since the creation of Pakistan 50 years ago, the Baloch have been reluctant partners at best. And it's a very poor province, and it's a very big province, but with a very small population. It's mostly desert, and I went there to see Bukti earlier this spring, and it's very stark how backward it is and how it's underdeveloped. And now there is great move to develop a deep sea port and to further excavate for gas and so on. And I think the Baluch are feeling more and more sidelined in their own province. And so there's a huge resentment that their place has been exploited and they've been neglected. So that goes across the whole province, across the different political parties. And, of course, in fact, all the Baluch want to get richer. They want to be developed, but they feel that they greatly fear that they will be done out of the riches and others will come in and take them. And so... It's a federal issue of fairness within the federal country of Pakistan.
Well, coupled with all of this, you have, let's do the laundry list here. Opposition leaders in Pakistan's parliament pushing for a vote of no confidence in the country's prime minister. They fell short of the necessary votes, but still it indicates there's thinking that there's corruption in the government, that the government isn't democratic. Then add to that a very large earthquake last October in the province of Kashmir, and the government's been criticized for its slow response. Add to that, as we well know, many of the suspects in the recent alleged London plane bomb plot were said to have ties to Pakistan. So how much, Carlotta, does all of this unrest have to do with the war on terrorism and the fear that this instability in Pakistan is going to create a vacuum for more terrorists to come in?
Well, I think what the Pakistani government is actually ready to admit is that Pakistan is reaping the rewards of supporting 20 years of Islamic Jihad in Afghanistan, neighboring Afghanistan. They supported the Afghans when they were fighting the Russians. They then supported the Taliban, and they knew there were training camps going on. So there's been an incredible militarization of Pakistan society over 20 years, and now they're suffering the consequences, and only now, really since the war on terror, have they, I think, realized quite how deep and how far it goes and how dangerous it is to their own society. So now it's a matter of changing minds, but you can't change minds overnight. And there's a lot of criticism that Pakistan is not doing it quickly enough. But when you see how some of these people think, you realize it's a very long job. It's changing their lives, it's reducing poverty, it's bringing education, it's showing people that there's a difference between jihad to fight a genuine war of occupation and doing terrorism. But you can see if it's reached the second generation of immigrants in England, who originally are from Pakistan but not necessarily having very close links, then you've got a very long, deep-seated problem throughout society. The strange thing is, why do you then also pick a fight with the Baluch nationalists, who are essentially secular? I mean, they're Muslims, but they're not fighting any kind of religious war. So it's quite strange to see Pakistan dealing with the Baluchistan problem in the way they are when you've got such a huge problem all along the Afghan border from Islamic radicals as well. So Pakistan does have a lot of problems, and it's a very fragile state. And having said that, when I live in Afghanistan, you know, you can see that actually at least Pakistan does have a functioning state and a functioning army and police force. So it's a very volatile mix in the whole region, and it's going to stay volatile, I think, for a long time.
Carlotta Gall, Pakistan and Afghanistan correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
And still to come today, we'll hear about the kitchens of Mexico with the Julia Child of Mexican cuisine, Diana Kennedy. You're listening to Here and Now. Playing in his 21st U.S. Open tennis tournament, Andre Agassi heads into the second round tonight with a sore back, so sore that he subjected himself to a cortisone shot yesterday. The focus is on Agassi because this is the final U.S. Open of his Hall of Fame career. So here to talk about tennis and other goings-on in the world of sports, only a game host, Bill Littlefield, joins us in the studio. Welcome, as always, Bill.
Thank you, Robin.
Andre Agassi, what a match the other night that got him this far. I fell asleep in the middle, but he clawed his way through that, didn't he?
He certainly did.
And here he is. Can he do this? Can he, you know, it would be such a fairy tale ending to win the U.S. Open. Is that possible?
No.
Oh.
Short answer to that question. At 36 with a sore back, he's not going to win the tournament.
No. But, I mean, it's just been amazing to he came skipping out the other night. I mean, what is it? To explain a little more. 36 years old, is that ancient for tennis?
Well, it's not, it's not the age at which tennis players generally win tournaments.
Right.
That's for sure.
And who else is in the draw?
Well, Roger Federer is in the draw, of course, and unless Tiger Woods is also in the draw, I'd have to give him the edge. What do you think?
I think he might be. Although Roddick was looking great. On the women's side, the Martina Hingis comeback continues. What else should we be looking for the women?
Well, that's a good story, her comeback, because usually comebacks are made by people who aren't still teenagers, and she almost is.
Yeah.
But yes, that's a good story. The other side of the story in the women's draw is Serena Williams, who is, of course, one of the reasons Martina Hingis retired to begin with. The other players were bigger and stronger and hitting the ball harder, and Serena Williams is back after a lot of injuries, and if she won, it would be a great story because she goes into the tournament unseeded.
Right. Well, I have to add, too, watch for the I Feel Pretty ad, which features Maria Sharapova. And you really do pity any girl who isn't her tonight when she sort of slams the ball. That's kind of funny.
Yeah, that's great.
Look for that. Speaking of women, the WNBA finals underway. Game one last night, the defending champs, the Sacramento Monarchs, defeated the Detroit Shock 95-71. Are you shocked?
I was shocked by one thing. Swin Cash, playing for Detroit, failed to score in that game. The first time all season that that's happened, and it's a little ironic because the only reason the Shock got to the second round is because Detroit coach Bill Laimbeer took Swin Cash aside before the second game of that series and said, "We need you. You got to do better than you've been doing so far." And she came up with a great game, and the Shock is in the finals, and then in the first game she goes scoreless. So. I said on this program a couple of weeks ago, I didn't think the Monarchs would repeat, and now it looks as if, as usual, my prediction is rubbish.
And by the way, I love to hear Bill Laimbeer's name. Wasn't he the Celtics nemesis about a
thousand years ago? He was either McFilty or McNasty. I can't remember
right.
Which, according to Johnny
right.
Most.
Well, basketball, U.S. team continues to shine in the Men's World Basketball Championship, this tournament being played in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
American pros are in the semifinals, but the U.S. hasn't had much success in international play recently, and I think that's putting it mildly.
Right. A sixth-place finish and a third-place finish. Not so good in the Olympics, not so good in the World Championships, at least by previous standards, dream team-type
right.
standards.
So,
the U.S. plays Greece in the semis, and then, assuming they get past Greece, they play either Spain or Argentina in the final, and that should be a terrific game.
And what has changed?
Well, one thing that has changed, one thing that has accounted for the success so far in this tournament is Mike Krzyzewski, the Duke coach who has taken over the U.S. team. And according to some of the people that I've talked to who are over there, their favorite cliche has surfaced. The U.S. team is on a mission. I hate that. I can't imagine what it actually means. But I suppose it means that they're playing with more intensity and playing a little bit more as a team. Certainly more of the players have been getting more playing time, which means that you're more likely to be able to play effective defense in the second half because you aren't going with a bunch of guys who are already exhausted, and that may have something to do with their success.
Okay, in the minute or so we have left, Major League Baseball. Oh, wait, not enough time because I don't want to talk about the Red Sox who have just been on such a complete collapse. So National League, every team still in the playoff race?
Unless you're the Pittsburgh Pirates, you're still in there. You still have a chance. And, of course, this was the way it was supposed to work when they went to this system of wild cards. The only problem is all the teams are mediocre, so it almost doesn't matter which one gets to the playoffs.
And one of the baseball teams currently really stinks. Bill Littlefield, the host of NPR's Only a Game, joins us every now and again to talk about the world of sports, and we always thank you. Check out his show on the weekend. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
More ahead here and now. nearby backcountry bus or pickup truck to remote valleys and ancient villages. What she's brought back is the culture of a great cuisine, a mix of native and Spanish food and culture. She documents the incredible variety of plants, animals, and insects that thrive on Mexican soil, making this rich cuisine possible. And now she's warning that it's all threatened by the changes brought on by globalization and the introduction of pesticides being sprayed on crops. Diana Kennedy now joins us from her organic farm and home, Quinta Diana, on a rough phone line. We're so grateful, though, Diana Kennedy. I know you're completing a new book on regional cuisine, but tell us, what do you like? What do you think are the real tastes of Mexico?
Well, don't forget I'm sort of a bit of a hippie myself because I love the wild foods, you know. The way that people use the wild foods, all the wild mushrooms, all the wild herbs and things like that, and that they're totally, of course, totally organic and wonderful flavors and textures. But I think most of all, they've experimented a lot with the chilies, because there are so many different types of chilies.
Remind us, I've got one of your books in front of me. I've been sort of thumbing through the huge volume of My Mexico, but remind us what some of the different chilies are.
Well, first of all, the poblano, which is the great big one that you stuff, and it's very delicious flavor. And then it's dried, which again has a totally different texture and totally different flavor. And there's the jalapeno, of course, the serrano. And then, of course, there are all these regional chilies that don't sometimes see the light of day out of their regions. And, of course, ones that I love are the chilhuacles and the chili de árbol, which is very hot and a long, skinny chili. The habanero, with its wonderful flavor and a wonderful bite to it. So those are just a few.
Just a very few.
I know. It's a very big subject.
And a huge amount of different kinds of food that come from this country. You've been traveling, peeking in people's kitchens. We understand you first went to Mexico for love. You married New York Times correspondent Paul Kennedy. You stayed, even after he died, for the love of what? I mean, what is it for you? What's the appeal for you?
Well, I think it's the country, probably first. In this wonderful country, there are so many diverse things to learn about, to see the beauty of the landscape and the landscapes that produce all these foods. And I was so curious about where the things came from. You know, I was trying all these new dishes and cooking them and learning about them. And then I wanted to see what it was like in that region where they made them. What were they growing? How were they cooking the corn? What type of corn do they have? So there were a thousand things, and lots of still unanswered.
And reading one of your cookbooks is like reading a history of the country and how food is made. You saw goats slaughtered and, you know, corn ground, as you said. But now you're worried about a combination of lack of attention to the ecology in the country and the encroaching globalization. What is your concern about? How do those two things, the environment and globalization, how do they impact the food that you've come to love?
They're importing, and this should never be allowed, from China, very cheap chilies, and they don't have the same flavor. And this sort of thing, there are beans being imported, I'm sorry, from the U.S., black beans. Well, the black beans of Mexico have such a wonderful flavor. The ones from the south, particularly, I'm talking about Oaxaca and Veracruz and that area. And so with all these cheaper things coming in, people's tastes are changing. Like, I always quote the apple, you know, the great big red shiny apple from the U.S., which has no flavor, whereas in Mexico they have some wonderful apples, and there's one apple that comes out in the spring, and it's so delicious. And people will go for these big, shiny things and think that it must be better because it's imported.
It's from the United States, so it must be good. And it's because of NAFTA that these apples and other pears from California and Seattle are coming in.
Yes.
And you read, in addition to the Mexicans then, you know, not having, and it sounds like in your opinion, the better fruit, it also really jeopardizes their economy because these poorer Mexicans, well, you tell us why.
Yes, because after all, if the beans, we're importing beans from the U.S., these campesinos or the people who are growing these can't sell them at a higher price, and therefore they're to go to the U.S. to have a living. So, I mean, it's counterproductive, I think, in many ways.
Your concern also is with the environment and the fact that, as you were saying, you're very interested in the poor Mexicans who forage for a lot of their food, mushrooms you mentioned, and also I read ant eggs.
Yes. Oh, they're delicious. Have you never had ant eggs? Robin, the next time you come to Mexico, you have to have them.
Well, okay. And as you point out that the poorer people are using them, you know, that it's a source of protein.
Yes, which is rather interesting because the people do actually earn a lot by selling those to the fancy restaurants in Mexico City. So it's a luxury. And it's very interesting to see this contrast between the foods that are collected locally and eaten locally without thinking about them. It's just part of their tradition. And the fact that these have become luxuries.
I didn't realize, how many contributions Mexico did make to food. Tomatoes, zucchinis, I think, come from Mexico.
Yes. Oh, cacao.
What's that, cacao?
Chocolate. cacao beans for chocolate. Peanuts, all sorts of things. And all many... many of the fruits, and the turkey, of course.
What is disappearing?
Some of the chilies are disappearing, very much so. But I think it's mostly people's tastes are changing so that they're not in demand. You've got to have a public who'll buy these things and appreciate them for what they're worth. So that's, I think, the key point.
I'm reading Alma Guillermo Prieto's piece about you in The New Yorker, and she described the meal that you cooked for Prince Charles when he came to visit you in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Cream of squash flour soup, followed by pork loin baked in banana leaves and served with cactus and young fresh peas in a green chili sauce. For dessert, guavas stuffed with coconut, along with mango sorbet topped by tequila-soaked strips of mango.
It was Lent, and he wasn't going to eat meat, and he didn't eat lunch anyway. But there were masses of Lenten dishes with beans and rice and pumpkin seed dips and white beans with dried shrimp and all sorts of things. A siquilpac, which is a pumpkin seed dip from Yucatan, and there was a guacamole with fruit, and you name it, I cooked it. It was tremendous cookout. The pork was just for the carnivores.
But, reading that menu, it's all you need to know that we don't, or most of us, don't know as much as we should about Mexican food.
I think people are learning much more. I think this curiosity has been caused by the young chefs talking about it, and I hope by my books, because it's such an exciting country, such an exciting cuisine. You have to forget all your other concepts. You have to put in a whole other program. When you go to Mexico, just to put another program into your self-computer and enjoy and be curious and go to the markets and ask how they do things and, make it an adventure.
Diana Kennedy, for 50 years, she's been writing about and researching the foods of Mexico. We're speaking to her from her home in Mexico. And thank you so much for the time, Diana.
Oh, thank you very much, Robin. It was a great pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The linguist behind the online language log sheds light on the subtle aspects of grammar. Also, online citizen filmmakers document life after Katrina, New Orleans. That's Public Radio's Daily Dive.